Welcome to Writer Types. I am your host, Eric Beatner, and I have someone with me today who puts the special in special guest co-host. It's the co-creator of Writer Types himself, Mr. S.W. Loudon. Welcome back, Steve.
Oh, Eric, thanks so much. I don't know what happened. I've been trying to log in for the last 18 months. Like, what's been happening? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I gotta say, I mean, I felt like for the past like 50 episodes or so, you've been very quiet.
I felt like that's what you always wanted, and so I was just trying to give you your wish because I love you that much, Eric. But really, it was a computer issue. I've literally been at my computer in my little man shed in the backyard for 18 months trying to log in.
Well, it is good to hear your voice, and it's good to see you again. And I want to talk about your latest nonfiction project, because you are really killing it in the nonfiction music space, as they say. The latest one, it's up for pre-order now. It's called Forbidden Beat: Perspectives on Punk Drumming. And, you know, if I were to think of anyone in the world to edit a collection with that title, it would have to be you. So tell us how this project came about.
Thanks, man. And thank you for your amazing essay in the collection about DC hardcore and post-punk. It is fantastic and really displays all of your deep knowledge about the music that came from that scene. So I can't thank you enough for being part of it.
Oh, well, no, thanks for having me. Anytime I get to talk about all my favorite bands, then yeah, why not?
Yeah, I mean, look, you and I talked about music a lot throughout the years and all the various episodes on this podcast. And obviously, one of the things you and I always connected about was our punk rock backgrounds and our shared love of punk music. I happen to be a drummer, and I read, as you know, a lot of nonfiction music books, bios, essay collections, deep dives into scenes. And what I started noticing was there weren't any books that I could find that were specifically about punk drumming. And I kept looking for them, and I would find great biographies. I would find great autobiographies, but I just wasn't finding the book that was sort of looking at punk rock from the perspective of behind the drum set. Because in my estimation, 99% of the time, you can't have great punk bands without great drummers, right? It's just that you go hand in hand for the most part. I just started thinking about that. I talked to Tyson Cornell at Rare Bird Books. Obviously, he's a punk musician. He really loved the idea. And I just started putting my feelers out and contacting, basically, this is the greatest thing in the world. I was just basically contacting my heroes and going, hey, will you be in my book? I love you.
Well, you've established yourself as quite the rock journalist these days. You're flinging out articles, you're doing, you know, taking it upon yourself to do these deep dives of the stuff that really interests you. But in a way, this is kind of getting back to your roots in writing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I went to journalism school I was very arts and entertainment focused. I wrote a lot of music reviews because I was a musician, am a musician. That's what I did in college. That's what I did after college. And then I worked actually as an editor at a newspaper in my hometown for a few years in my 20s, and then I signed a record deal and kind of like left my journalism career and pursued music professionally, and then I pursued writing. And eventually I started just finding myself gravitating more and more to writing about music again, really leveraging my journalism background. I wanted to like talk about music, but I wanted to talk about it like a journalist. And so the great thing is there's lots of places you can publish these days without gatekeepers. And so I just started throwing my articles out places and raising my hand to co-edit books and getting to know people in this community. And it's been a lot of fun, if nothing else. And I'm really proud so far of the body of work I've been able to create.
Well, since you left the show, you've definitely been very busy. You've also got the power pop heist novellas. So you still got one foot in crime fiction as well. What is it about us, Steve, that we can't slow down?
Well, I think you maybe right now are winning the can't slow down race, if I'm being honest about it, because at a certain point I had to hit the eject button on Writer Types because I was just taking on too much and there literally was not enough time in the day or the week. So, I mean, I would actually flip that back on you. Like, you've not slowed down at all. If anything, you've stepped on the gas with submitting short stories and getting stuff published and, you know, continuing to do this podcast and pursuing all the passion projects that you have as well. So how do you do it?
It's fear of death.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I thought.
that's all it is.
I'm glad we settled that.
Hey, Steve, do you remember when we interviewed Lee Child?
I do remember that. I think of that very fondly. What a cool dude.
Yeah, well, I got to interview Lee Child again. And this time I also got to speak with Andrew Grant, writing as Andrew Child, since he took over the Jack Reacher books. And it was really great to talk to both brothers at the same time about the brand new Reacher book, Better Off Dead. It's a fascinating process that they've gone through, handing over the reins of this incredibly popular series from brother to brother. I have to ask him, if you ever decide to fully retire from crime fiction, do I get the rights to your old characters?
Are you telling me you're my brother?
No, but I always felt like we were kind of like brothers. I don't have any brothers, so you're as close as I get.
Okay, well then you can have the Powerpuff Heist. They're all yours, buddy. Run with it. Finish.
Well, welcome, gentlemen, to both of you. Better Off Dead is the latest Jack Reacher novel and the second collaboration between you two. Now, Lee, when we last spoke, I was so intrigued by something you said. You said that the first line of every Reacher book never changes. Once it's down on paper, that's it. And the first line of this one is, if I may read, "The stranger got into position under the streetlight at 11 p.m. as agreed." And I want to know, does this rule still apply now that Andrew is writing the books?
Well, you're going to have to ask my co-writer that, because this was a very intriguing genesis to this particular novel. Better Off Dead started out in a way that procedurally I was not expecting, because what happened was Andrew got an idea, and like a lot of writers, you got to start playing with it, and did that entire first chapter kind of in secret. You know, he was just trying something out, and he emailed it to me, and I thought it was wonderful, just a fantastic first chapter, and it just filled me with enthusiasm for the rest of the book, because if you get a great start, then it gets easier after that. And so the first line, I don't know, he might have written it 10 times, he might have written it only once, we'll have to ask him.
Okay, so Andrew, was it a mandate when you took over that you have to keep the first line intact?
Not so much that we have to start this way. I mean, the method, you know, the no outlining, the making every decision kind of instinctively and organically as we go, wasn't so much of a mandate, but it was like the way that I knew Lee worked, and I wanted to work the same way because I want to come up with the same product. So it seemed sensible to me that if I want it to look the same and sound the same, I need to work the same. You know, it seemed crazy to think I'm going to get the same result if I do it in a different way. But with this, once I came up with the first line, it didn't change. What did slightly change in my head, though, was that when I came up with the idea, I was actually going to start it somewhere else. I was going to start it where the kind of the next chapter starts. And then I don't know where it came from. You know how you sometimes just get these ideas? It just was blindingly obvious to me, no, that's the wrong place to start. This is where you've got to start. And once I had that revelation, it flowed really fast.
The genius of that opening chapter, though, is that we don't know who this stranger is. And we sort of think, well, it's Reacher. Gotta be, right? This is Reacher. And then, you know, these four guys turn up unauthorized and you think, yeah, great, this is Reacher. We assume. And then at the end of the chapter, we're kind of hoping it wasn't Reacher. It's a brilliant tease for the book, and I was thrilled with it. I was sitting right here, actually, when my phone dinged and the email of this chapter came in. I remember it really well. I read it on my phone. I couldn't even be bothered to go upstairs and use my regular computer. I read it on my phone and I thought, oh my God, this is going to kill people.
So Andrew, I mean, it's got to be the biggest challenge of this to keep some of your authorial voice and yet also to assimilate into the Reacher voice. I mean, has that truly been the biggest hurdle to overcome with this whole handoff?
Absolutely, Eric, you've nailed it. You know, understanding the character, knowing the character, that's something that didn't happen overnight. That's something that I kind of had a 25-year apprenticeship with, really, because I was the first person to read a Reacher book. You know, I read Killing Floor when it was still written in pencil. And every year past that, you know, every time Lee and I got together, whenever we hung out, if we went to a baseball game, if we went to a museum, whatever we were doing, we were constantly riffing off, you know, made up stuff. We'd be saying, oh, what would Reacher do about this? What would Reacher do about that? So understanding the character, I felt was something something that had evolved over a long period of time. But what was absolutely going to be more of a challenge was when I put down those adventures and those thoughts and those deductions and everything that Reacher loves onto the page, how was I going to make it sound the same? Because, you know, Lee and I have always had the shared belief that really it's not about the author at all. It's about the character. What we want is for people to buy the new Reacher, not the new Lee Child, not the new Andrew Child, but the new Reacher, and to enjoy it just as much as they've ever enjoyed any of the previous ones. I mean, from my point of view, I might say I hope they enjoy it even more. Lee might not agree. But we always felt it's not about him or me, it's about Reacher. So getting Reacher to sound the same was the thing. And that was actually made even harder by the fact that I'd written 9 other books where I was deliberately, with every single word I wrote, trying not to sound like my brother. You know, I was determined that my career was going to be independent, that I was going to stand or fall on my own 2 feet, and that nothing I wrote would ever sound like it was in any way related to anything that he wrote. So having been firmly entrenched in that method for, I guess, 15 years pretty much, I then suddenly on a dime had to turn around 180 degrees and then make it so that I would sound like him. So it's, that was a big challenge.
Of the new book, Booklist had such a great quote. They said, quote, "The mixture of brute force and intellectual problem solving is just right." And to me, I mean, that is the perfect distillation of Jack Reacher. Lee, was that kind of what you set out to do over 20 years ago when you created this character, that blend of intellect and brute force?
Yeah, I really wanted to do that. I remember a review from early on that said, Reacher is a liberal intellectual with forearms the size of Popeyes. And I thought, yeah, that's what we want. We want a guy who is physically secure. You know, that was a kind of wish fulfillment thing for me and for everybody, I think, who reads it. You can be walking down the street. I remember it well when I was younger, when I could stay up late. You know, I'd be at a party or something, and I'd be walking home at 4 a.m. or something like that, or 5 a.m. and you see some guy walking towards you 100 yards away. You're just a little bit worried all the time. Suppose he didn't have to be. Suppose that it was a billion to one that the next guy around the corner was as good as you physically. How would you feel? You'd feel really good. You'd feel relaxed. You'd feel much happier. So that was wish fulfillment for all of us, really. And then the other thing is, I just always loved Sherlock Holmes. You know, I love that sleight of hand that an author can have. And people love that too. They love to think along with the character. That's a huge part of the appeal, I think. Readers love to see something done really well. And so I wanted to give him some more of that. And of course, it's very easy from the writer's point of view. I figured that out early. You know, as a kid, I'd be reading Sherlock Holmes, and he'd have this thing, you know, he looks out the window and he says, "Oh, Watson, here's somebody coming to our door, clearly a bricklayer from Shoreditch who's been out of work for 9 months. And, you know, he comes up the stairs, Mrs. Hudson shows him in, and yeah, he's a bricklayer from Shoreditch who's been out of work for 9 months. And the reader is thrilled by the deductive powers. But of course, Conan Doyle is on both ends of the equation there. In real life, of course, he comes upstairs and you say, "Are you a bricklayer from Shoreditch?" And he says, "No, mate." You know, fiction is wonderful for being able to do what you want to do.
After 20 plus years of writing Reacher, I have to imagine you've actually become somewhat of an amateur physician with all you know about how to dislocate a limb or where to kick someone to tear a ligament or where to land a punch directly on a nerve ending. I mean, Andrew, has Lee become a source of research for any of this stuff? Like, if you have to know exactly where to hit a guy in the solar plexus to get, you know, this or that result, do you just ask Lee?
I think it has to come from within. I don't think it's the sort of thing that would work too well if you were relaying somebody else's sort of instructions on it. I think it has to be something that you feel and that you see. And that's a great example of showing how Reacher thinks, because everybody thinks about the fight scenes and the action in the Reacher books. But if you look at the scenes carefully, you'll see that a lot of the time Reacher will spend more time thinking about the coming confrontation, planning it out, you know, reasoning, you know, the scene from One Shot, for example, that worked really well in the movie was where Reacher goes outside from the diner with the six guys after the woman's come and provoked the confrontation. And, you know, it looks like it's six guys, but Reacher explains to them how it's not really six because two of them will run away and two will hang back and see what happens. You know, so the way that it breaks down, there's a lot, you know, the thinking side and the planning and the anticipating is really the most important part, I think. And then, you know, those details are great. I mean, I remember, I think it might even have been Die Trying, possibly, quite an early book anyway. I remember there was a bit about the best way to give somebody a concussion. And I remember, Lee, you telling me that you'd read about that in a car magazine when it was telling you about how airbags worked and why it was important to have them positioned in particular places in a car, you know. So interesting stuff like that you can use in a different setting with a different purpose.
Well, I want to know, how does it change over the years? Because when you start out, you're writing for yourself, but then that grows over time. And something like this, Lee, I mean, the easy thing would have been to end the series and walk away. But instead, you felt an obligation to the readers. Is that right?
The transition came about because based on my experiences as a reader, I was very afraid of becoming that guy, you know, the author that does the long series and after, you know, maybe 8 or 10 books, clearly doesn't care anymore. Actually, that's going away. I mean, when I look at my contemporaries in the business right now, they are all good and they are all working hard all the time and they're all conscientious and they're really not falling into the trap. But historically, it used to be a terrible thing. Alastair MacLean would be an example. He was just great for, you know, 8 books were beyond fantastic. And then he got old and bored and drunk and moved to a tax exile and just started phoning it in. And I felt awful as a kid, you know, as a reader, it had been taken away from me. And I promised myself I would never do that. And I never did. But I knew that it was coming. Maybe not next year, maybe not the year after, but sooner or later, I was going to run out of gas. And so, yeah, it was time to end the series, in my opinion, because I was not going to give the reader an inferior product.
Right.
But I was really sad about it. You know, I'd loved doing it. And I'd especially loved the fact that people loved the character. But then I suddenly realized, wait a minute, you idiot. You know a guy who is who is like you 15 years ago, you know, still got that energy and creativity and ideas. You know a person like that. I would have not done it with any other collaborator at all. But I figured Andrew, my actual brother, you know, DNA is the same. Our experiences are the same. The way it's turned out, our personalities are very similar. So I thought, if anybody can find that 5% of madness, it's him, because he's probably got it himself.
Well, Lee, you are also one of those guys who is having a retirement that isn't really a retirement at all. I mean, there's the Reacher TV show, you know, and now, I mean, here you are doing interviews for the new book. Did this change in authors in some way, like kind of give you a second wind?
Yeah, I mean, the transition was supposed to be slow. We sort of talked to the publishers about it. And, you know, the idea was that over, let's say, 3 books, maybe we did this smooth transition where we started out together and I progressively took a step back and Andrew took a step forward. And we're still going to stick to that plan. It's been completely screwed up by the pandemic in certain ways. But I will be stepping back into total obscurity as soon as I possibly can.
And Andrew, are you ever wanting this transition to go a little more quickly? Like, you know, Lee, go have a smoke. I got this one from here.
Well, it's a very funny thing that, because when we started, I was, one of the things I was most looking forward to was I thought this will just be, you know, it's my job, but I get to do it with my brother. It's going to be lovely. And we had anticipated that, you know, because we live 3.5 miles apart, and we thought, great, you know, we'll be able to sit, you know, sit across the desk, nose to nose, thrash it out, talk things through, you know, come up with all the good ideas together. And that lasted for a couple of months. But then when the pandemic came, we wound up working completely remotely, which in a way was brilliant, because without us expecting this, really, what we realized was that if we are sitting down in the same room, you know, imagine, you know, anybody doing it, two people, you're going to present something that you've written to the other person. You can't help but say, well, this is why I did it. This is how I think it works. This is why I think it's important. Yeah. This is what I think it will lead to. You know, you've got to preface it. You've got to support it and justify it. So then when the other person reads it, they've got all of that stuff in their mind. You can't unhear it. And so that's not like someone who buys the book. That's not the way they read it. You know, they read it without any preconceptions. Yeah, yeah. So when we went to working remotely and we would just email back and forth, it was actually magnificent, because all that you did was open the email. There was a document with some words on, and those words worked or they didn't. And if they didn't, we were very honest with each other and said, no, we need more work on that. And so we had the same experience as somebody buying the book at the bookstore. You open it and the words either work for you or they don't. So that part of the experience was great, because we don't have that experience of sitting down together every day working together, and it's just working. You're still working on your own in a way. Yeah, I'm totally happy to just pick up the baton and run with it. Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say what Andrew said. Yeah, I mean, literary wise, it's been a benefit. Because yeah, all we've had is the words, the same as the reader. Socially, it has been a terrible disappointment, because, you know, we don't get to hang out. Andrew's wife, Tasha, fabulous cook. I was bitten to get there in the morning, have a whole bunch of cinnamon buns and muffins and a pot of coffee and all of that. And so none of the social things happened, but I think actually the books came out better because of it.
Well, there you go. There's a silver lining.
Thank you, Eric. Great speaking with you.
Thanks, Eric. It was a pleasure as always.
All right, Steve. Next up is Wanda M. Morris, and she is the debut author of All Her Little Secrets. And this book is getting all kinds of attention, and it's very well deserved. Wanda is a lawyer, and this novel is set in the world of high-powered corporate law, with a woman at the center of a scandal and a murder, who's also trying to keep her family secrets hidden at all costs when her life is kind of falling apart around her. I think at this point, a law degree is probably more likely to get you published than an MFA in creative writing. I mean, there's so many lawyers turned writers, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they've got all the inside information, right? There's all the verisimilitude to the stories that they're able to tell from a legal perspective. They have to know how to write. And I'm sure that they are tapping into a well of experiences that, you know, mere mortals like you and I don't have access to. But Eric, I'm curious, you said debut author, and it's got me wondering, how many debut authors do you think have been featured on this show? Because I feel like it's a lot.
Oh, it's been a whole lot, yeah. The publishing world loves a debut, and we have to have had over 100 at this point, I would think. I remember those innocent days of the debut novel. Seems so long ago.
I don't at all.
Oh, we love a debut author here on Writer Types, and your debut, Wanda, is All Her Little Secrets. And Elise, in this book, she certainly has some secrets. The big secret is threatened right there in chapter one, when I don't think this is a spoiler for anyone. Her boss, who she is having an affair with, she discovers has been killed in his office. She makes this decision to protect herself and her other secrets, which, you know, is the downfall of so many characters and, frankly, so many real life people, right? Why do we think that we can constantly outrun our past?
That's an interesting question. I think because we put on these new facades and believe, yep, I'm nice, I'm fresh, I'm new, and here I go off into the world. And I think that's exactly what Elise Littlejohn was attempting to do. Everything from the way she lived to the way she dressed to her educational pedigree. She put on a new set of clothes and decided that was a different person. And she was off to live a different life.
And yet it keeps reaching out from her past to maybe drag her back in. I think that's something that I found, for a character who's very different from myself, that certainly is something that I think is very relatable, is someone who, like you say, she's trying to raise her station in life. She's trying to, uplift herself. And yet there's always those ties to your upbringing, right? That you can't escape.
Exactly. I think that's a through line conflict in the book, is that for all the effort that she puts into trying to be this different person, deep down inside, she really knows who she is. And she really loves those people who are in the past that she attempts to keep buried. And so it's a real torment for her, I think. I like to think that we all kind of have, maybe not secrets quite as dark as Elise's, but, we all have something in our past that, whether we regret or we wish we'd done differently. And the hope is that we can start anew.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just helping my daughter with a project in her English class where they're talking about the hero's journey, and they were talking about, heroes going back to Odysseus, and now the rise of sort of anti-heroes, or at least characters with flaws. And I thought it was interesting that, literally right from page one, you sort of set up Elise as someone who, it would be very easy to paint her as this woman she's achieved so much. She's got this incredible education. That's this fabulous job. And yet you start her off with, she kind of knows that she's making a bad decision with this affair she's having. So right off the bat, you set her off with some character flaw. You know, she's going to be a complicated woman right from page one. Was that an important thing for you to do, is give her these different levels and not have her just be the woman who made good?
Absolutely. My attempt with her was to show that even though she was incredibly smart, because she had, this educational pedigree, she was witty, she was charming, but like people in real life can be very smart, but still make some incredibly bad decisions. And, her decisions, or at least what I try to convey to the reader, is that her decisions, good, bad, and otherwise, stem from something that happened back in her past. And not only is she trying to run from it, I think that she's also trying to grapple with that. And so she looks for things in, for example, a bad relationship, a bad, affair. Or she looks across the hall at her neighbor and wishes that, gosh, I wish I had had someone like that in my life. And so she's always searching for what she lacked as she was growing up.
Oh, well, aren't we all?
Exactly. Hello.
Well, you set this in Atlanta, where you live, and in a world of lawyers, in which you travel yourself. And, for me, having never been through that experience, I can only imagine that you brought a lot of your own life experience as an African-American woman with a law degree. Elise finds herself often on the outside, often the only woman of color around. Unfortunately, in a lot of ways, I think a lot of this probably hits very close to home, right?
Indeed, it does. I've had those experiences where, like Elise in the book, you walk into a room or a party that's work related, and you start to, count the other women in the room or the other, black and brown people. And, I feel certain that white males don't typically do that on the regular. but, it is something. Or you're in a meeting and, you make a suggestion that is, roundly dismissed. And 5 minutes later, a white male makes the same suggestion almost verbatim, and everybody applauds him for it. Mm-hmm. And you think, wait a minute, are we in the same room? Like, what just happened here? And so, for me, I had to, whenever I was in those situations, I had to tell myself, you know, hey, I pay for my law degree just like everybody else sitting around this table. And I deserve to have a voice. I deserve to have a say in whatever decisions that we're making. Even though I'm dealing in, you know, a fictional world, I don't think that it is unlike what is typically seen now. I read a Fortune magazine article a few months back, and only 3% of executive management in Fortune 500 is Black.
Wow.
That is incredibly, incredibly low. And when you think about it, it's also quite sad because, you know, decisions start at the top.
Right.
And so if everyone looks alike in the executive suite, you're going to get thinking that's very much alike.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Elise, she goes to great lengths to protect her brother, often to her own detriment. I mean, family can have that sway over us sometimes, can't? I mean, this is why a lot of times I read a story like this and I feel a little bit grateful that my family isn't that close. If, you know, if any of my sisters, I would have to say, you're on your own, kid. But no one can drag you down like family, right? It's
I like the way you put that. Yeah, Elise has this really close relationship with her brother, and man, it always seems to be the bane of her existence, unfortunately, but she loves him, you know, dearly. And, you know, despite the body count in this book and all the murder and mayhem, I really did set out to write a family story. You know,
yeah.
This story really is about love and loss and, you know, resilience and redemption and all those things that you find in family. And so I wanted to explore, you know, the family we choose and the family that chooses us. And so you kind of see Elise in, you know, these situations with her, you know, biological family. And then you see her in this office situation where executive management refers to everyone as family, but they treat everyone far from it.
Right.
And so I wanted to explore those themes in this book.
What is it about lawyers that you keep turning to writing mysteries? I mean, I think, you know, of all the people I've interviewed, second maybe only to newspaper reporters, is there something about the job that you're always thinking of this, you know, it's a bit of an adversarial job. You've got, you know, you're trying to choose right and wrong. You've got, you know, what is it about being a lawyer that makes so many turn to writing these kind of books?
You know what? I think for me, when I read a book, I love a good secret in a book, a secret where the author drops breadcrumbs along the way. And I'm following you all the way to page 300 if you do that well. And I think lawyers, that's kind of the currency that they deal in. They deal in secrets because they have confidentiality rules and all these ethical rules. And that's one of the things that I tried to set up in this book is that Elise is caught in this quagmire because she's kind of got this moral dilemma and protecting her family and her secrets. But she's also got this professional dilemma, this ethical dilemma about what she has to do as a lawyer to protect her ethical standing and protect her license to practice as a lawyer. And so lawyers kind of deal in this currency of secrecy and, you know, making sure that the facts are presented a certain way. And for me, I love secrets in a book. So I wanted to explore it.
All right, there we go. We finally have the answer as to why, because I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a great analysis of what those two jobs share in common.
You might have to ask John Grisham what he thinks, but that's kind of, you know, my newbie author.
Well, look, for a new author, this book has been the talk of the town for quite a while now. You know, and as we approach release day, we're getting very close now. I feel like your pre-release couldn't have gone any better. It's been on lists. Your list of blurbs is very impressive, I must say. And this has been a long time coming to this moment, over a decade that you've been working on this book and shopping it and seeking an agent, all of those things that go into this overnight success that you're now experiencing. Now that you're on the verge of release, are you someone who can slow down and enjoy the moment, or are you already onto the next thing and focused on the future?
Gosh, I am trying to savor all of this because, to your point, I've waited so long for it. I still am like a kid in a candy shop. I'll see a blurb, or, you know, I'll see a list and I'm like, oh my God, that's my name. You know, like, who's that? It really, really is an amazing, surreal experience. And I don't take a minute of it for granted because it has been so long coming. I mean, between my doubts and, you know, the other folks who turned it down, their doubts too. I mean, it's been a long time coming, but I don't take a minute of it for granted.
Oh, good for you. I'm glad. Well, and look, now you've been on Writer Types. You've made it to the top of the mountain.
Bucket list, check.
All right, my final guest is William Boyle. He's the darling of modern-day noir fiction, and his latest Brooklyn-set novel is Shoot the Moonlight Out, and it follows his hot streak of these complex characters living lives of desperation and usually making terrible mistakes. He really is one of the best out there right now. Now, Steve, we chatted with him briefly in person at BoucherCon 1 year, and William is one of those writers, like, it's really been fun to sort of track his rise as we've seen him come up, hasn't it?
Yeah, I actually remember that. He was one of those, like, let's just ambush that dude as he's walking down the entryway of the hotel in Florida, right? Is that where we spoke with him?
Yes.
I love ambushing authors and just spitting ridiculous questions and terrible dad puns at them and just kind of recording their reaction.
I think any author is still a little bit surprised that anyone wants to talk to them. So everyone has always been so nice and so accommodating.
It's three authors standing there with our phones out with the voice memo recording, all kind of shocked that we're willing to talk to each other. Beautiful.
Yeah. So, William, I am speaking to you now from your home in Oxford, Mississippi, and yet Shoot the Moonlight Out is another book that is what I will say is aggressively Brooklyn. You have not been able to leave that town behind, have you?
No. Yeah, I don't see myself leaving it behind on the page in any way soon. It's where I'm from. It's where I kind of return to when I sit down to write pretty much every time.
Just unconsciously, or is it a plan that you're trying to exorcise demons from your past, or it's just what you know, so that's what you go to?
Well, I mean, I think it's what I'm haunted by. Not just what I know. I mean, it's the place I know best, certainly, but it's definitely the stuff I'm haunted by, and the stuff that when I sit down and I've kind of got a blank page in front of me, that's just where I kind of automatically go and return, the streets and the you know, just the places that I know and remember and also invent. There's kind of a mythological version of Brooklyn in my mind, I think, that kind of subsumes me.
And then invariably they lead to these dark crime stories. Is that, should I be worried about your past?
No. I mean, I think I'm just, you know, that's kind of my way into the angle I put on exploring kind of melancholy and heartbreak and, you know, the kind of unspecific sadness that I associate with being home, with growing up.
All right, well, that's if I delve any deeper into that, I'll have to charge you $100 an hour. So
yeah.
Well, Shoot the Moonlight Out, it has such a great tangled web of characters who start out seemingly on different paths, but then they sort of slowly come together by the threads that connect them, even if they are unaware of these threads connecting them. I can imagine the writing of this book involved maybe a wall of note cards and different colored strings between them so you could keep it all straight, or did it flow pretty naturally?
No, I don't do anything like that, really. I think I sit down at the beginning and I have, you know, kind of cast of characters in mind, or I start to assemble a cast of characters, and usually there are a couple or a few, and that opens up a little bit. And then I kind of just do a breakdown, kind of chapter by chapter breakdown of what I want to accomplish. But I also like to leave room for discovery and exploration and wandering within the world of the story. So yeah, I mean, I don't really plan it in that kind of crazy way. I don't enjoy that part of it. I mean, I like I like having things figured out so I can cut off trouble at the pass, but I'm not somebody who's got a big board in front of me with cards and strings.
Well, it's impressive then, because on this one there definitely is a lot of there's a lot of characters that overlap, and then you discover, oh my gosh, it's his sister, and all, you know, these sort of little discoveries along the way. So it was great that you were able to sort of hold that and keep it in check, or I don't know, maybe this was 10 revisions in when it all finally straightened out.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of that has to do with I'm definitely a bit of a coward when it comes to time, so I could imagine if I was setting this novel over many years, I could imagine having to do that level of planning. But because the novel, for the most part, you know, there's a prologue that's set in 1996, and then the bulk of the novel is set in over a few weeks in June 2001. So, you know, it's pretty compressed time period. So ultimately, it wasn't hard for me to keep track of. And, you know, anything that I did lose track of got smoothed over or dealt with in revision.
Well, you have that most coveted status of any crime writer. You are big in France. what have you heard from French readers that they latch onto about these very Brooklyn stories?
They like place-driven stuff, for sure. I mean, it's just an incredible literary culture. And so they're definitely drawn to place stories, and they're drawn to character-driven stuff, and they're drawn to dark stuff. They have darker tastes, I think, than the general American audience. So that's kind of all the stuff I do. And I think that's probably accounts for some of the interest in my books there. You know, the fact that I'm writing so specifically and so in-depth about a place and kind of creating a mythology of my version of Brooklyn, my Brooklyn, but also, you know, character-driven stories kind of rooted in a love of noir and 70s crime movies, and, you know, just all the things that they respond to in American culture and rock and roll. You know, I mean, they have similar tastes to me, you know, ultimately. You know, I can go to France. The title of this book, Shoot the Moonlight Out, comes from a Garland Jeffries song. Garland Jeffries is an artist I really love, and not a lot of people here really know him as much as they should, but I go to France and of course everybody knows him. They like good stuff generally, so I'm glad that they respond to my books.
Well, somewhere around here on my shelves, I have my Broken River edition of Gravesend. So I've been on board from the start with your work, sir.
Thank you.
In that time, has your writing taken the path that you thought it would when you started?
You know, I mean, I didn't have a path really laid out for myself. I didn't really have models. You know, I didn't grow up around writers, certainly. I didn't grow up around readers even. You know, so I kind of came to this all through just as a fan. You know, I always knew I was a writer and I wanted to write, and spent a long time figuring out what stories I wanted to tell and how I wanted to tell them. I think once I wrote Gravesend, though, I kind of had figured something out, and I knew that that was going to be the beginning of what I hoped would be kind of a continuing mythology or something, or a world of stories rooted in the place I knew best. And there were a couple of times along the way where I thought about straying from that path a little bit more, but it didn't work out, or I just didn't, and I kind of had figured out this way of doing things that worked for me.
Yeah, don't fix it if it ain't broke. It's interesting. I mean, it sounds like you had that moment where you really did recognize when you found your authorial voice.
Yeah, I mean, it took a long time. You know, I published Gravesend in my 33 or something. I mean, I've loved writing my whole life. I went through a lot of different versions of what I wanted to do with writing. I mean, I love film. So early on, I thought I wanted to try to write screenplays, and bailed on that pretty quickly, and thought I wanted to write poetry and realized I was not good at that. And, you know, but by the time I was 18 or 19, I knew that I wanted to write fiction. So it's been a while, and it took me really from then until Gravesend to really get it down and to find that. And, yeah, I had a lot of stuff in place, I think, early on in terms of the characters I was writing about and the place I was writing about, but other stuff needed to fall in around it. And I needed to figure out a lot.
Well, you've mentioned that you're a film fan, and that was my background. I mean, that's where my writing started, was in screenplays. And so I wonder, like, I always talk to other authors about who their other, you know, influences were in novels, but what about filmmakers for you? Is there sort of a filmmaker or some directors that you feel sort of a stylistic relationship to, and maybe you can count as influences as much as other novelists?
Oh yeah, I mean, many. I'm as inspired by film as literature and music. And I try to watch a movie a day if I can. I'm really something I kind of need to be creative, I think. So there's a ton. I mean, for the purposes of my books, I'd say probably Robert Altman and Alan Rudolph are two of the bigger influences in terms of just opening up ideas about ensemble, big ensemble casts and structure. That was stuff that really pulled me in, and you know, it was a way I wanted to tell stories. John Cassavetes, I love. You know, I mean, that's a huge, his films are a huge influence on me. A lot of classic stuff, obviously, too. But then I think stuff that probably maybe people wouldn't necessarily expect. The director, writer, director Lynn Shelton, who passed away. She's one of my favorites, and I think, you know, a film like her last film, Sword of Trust, had a kind of big influence on what I wanted to do in this book.
Yeah.
Also a big ensemble cast. So there's tons of people and tons of directors, but also tons of actors that inspire me and that make me excited to just sit down and write.
Yeah, I always think it's interesting how I think sometimes authors get too hung up on only talking about the other books that influence them without acknowledging, because I do think you're right. I think all of us get so many storytelling cues from a great film. And to me, it's always, it's such a great reminder of efficient storytelling. And you know, you tell these fully fleshed characters and these fully realized stories in 2 hours.
Yeah.
Just a reminder, like, I don't need to write a 600 page manuscript in order to get my idea across, you know?
Right. Yeah. And you know, I think there's also an element for me that it's sometimes just really instructive to learn from other art forms. I mean, you know, I when people ask me what my influences are, a lot of the time I'm primarily talking about films and music, and not talking about books. It's not that books aren't, they are in a major way, but I think a lot of times when I'm sitting down to kind of figure out the sound of a novel or the tone of a novel, it's the records I'm listening to, it's the movies I'm watching that are informing that in the most significant way.
And it's a lot easier to put on a 3-minute Garland Jeffries song to sort of get you in a headspace than it is to reread an entire, you know, James Ellroy novel or something.
Yeah, totally. And film too. I mean, you can rewatch. I mean, Detour is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I could watch Detour 6 times in a day. You know, that is a different level of engagement with a text, you know, that I really love.
Well, excellent. Well, congratulations on Shoot the Moonlight Out. It's another in this long line. You are really establishing yourself as one of the major voices in this dark noir fiction. So speaking as a fan, I'm with you. Don't change it. I'm not interested in your San Francisco novel. Just keep it in Brooklyn. Let's keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks so much for having me. It was great catching up. Great talking to you, and I appreciate it.
Steve, that's the end of our interviews, but I did have an ulterior motive in having you join me today, and it's time for us to announce...
Wait, are you actually my brother?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, go on then. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's not the big news. Big news is that this is the last episode of Writer Types. It is time to end the show.
What?
No. What? This is it.
This is how you tell me? I mean,
at least I'm doing it in person.
That's some shocking news. This is a fantastic crime podcast that you have kept trucking along and doing phenomenal work after your partner in crime abandoned you. And now you're telling me that this thing that I could continue to be proud of and take credit for, even though I had to do no work, is not going to exist anymore?
Yeah, that's how it's going. I'm pulling the plug.
Oh, boy. Well, how do you feel about it?
I feel really good. I have enjoyed doing the show immensely over the years. I'm incredibly proud of what we created along the way, and I leave with no regrets.
It couldn't get any better than that, then. I guess if you have to make a tough decision, you should feel confident and good about it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, believe me, I've threatened in private to end the show before, but it's never felt like the right time. But this feels like the right time. You know, I tried to look back and sort of look at what we've managed to accomplish. And some of the numbers were hard to even figure out because they were so big. I mean, we have done over 400 interviews, which seems nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Huge bestsellers, indie authors. We had debuts. We had nonfiction. We had horror writers, a little bit of everything. And one thing that I know we talked about at the very beginning when we were just deciding to do the show and coming up and trying to figure out what it was going to be and what we could feel passionate about that we would be able to take on the heavy workload that is making a podcast. And I'm very proud that we kept to our guns and we really kept an equal balance of male and female writers. We featured so many writers of color, LGBT authors. We kept our doors open to anyone with a book that we felt people should know about, no matter what the size of your publisher or if you were self-published. My only regret is that I didn't have time to talk to everybody that I wanted to talk to. There was just not enough time to get to all the books. So for anybody that I did not get to talk to that who pitched to be on the show, I apologize. I wish I could have talked to you. And that's the only thing that I leave with a slight twinge of regret about.
Well, there are limits to space and time, Eric, and you are also a father and a husband, and you have a job, and you also managed to crank out 22 novels a year. So anybody would have to understand if you couldn't quite squeeze another 800 people onto the show as you were walking out the door.
Well, let's hope so. And let's not forget the accents, Steve. Over the years, we have featured authors, let's get this, from Canada, England, Scotland, Ireland, France, Germany, Australia, Iceland, Sweden, and Sri Lanka.
Two or three of those countries aren't even real. You're just like making stuff up. Well, Eric, you keep saying we, which is incredibly generous. And though I am so proud of what we created together, I would not dare take even 20% of the credit for all the work you did while we were a team. And all the incredible work you did after I left the show, and you just kept soldiering on, and it just got better and better. And when I listened in, I was like, man, you know, he's doing all the things that I held him back on. So I think you deserve a huge round of applause for all that you've done solo and that we did together. But I don't, this isn't a we, this is a, you did this all the way through and I was there for part of the ride.
Well, I would not be here had we not come up with this together, nor would I have had the courage to start it on my own without a partner in crime to do this. I mean, I have to say thank you for starting this crazy thing with me, for helping me get it off the ground. And getting to spend time with you doing this and just our friendship in general, it really is one of the highlights of my writing life. I mean, of all the things that I've accomplished in publishing, it's the friendships and the relationships that I take away, and yours is one of my most prized relationships. I'll always be enormously proud of what we built here, and the episodes will still be available. People can still find them. All the interviews are still completely relevant, even if the books are a few years old. It was worth all the time that we spent, all of the effort, the money that we lost along the way, because this thing has never been profitable. You know, we talked about, should we pick favorites? Should we do some sort of a top 10? And it's too hard to choose favorites. We don't want to lift anybody above anybody else. They were like, literally, we enjoyed every interview that we did on its own merits for different reasons. And we just had some amazing conversations that we never would have had it not been for the show.
I could not agree more, Eric. That sentiment is definitely mutual. The friendship that you and I built, and out of that friendship, the show that came out of it and the conversations we still have, even though I'm not on the show anymore, mean the world to me.
All right. Well, you know, Steve, as long as this is our last episode ever, we cannot leave without talking one last time to the Malmans. So here they are, all the way from Minnesota, Dan and Kate Malman. Welcome back to the show.
Hooray! I wish that was the intro you gave us, like, for the whole time we had the show. That was like a Johnny Carson curtain opening.
Dan, with the current references, like usual.
If we could wrap this up, I have to go to bed soon. And of course, it is just 6:04 in the evening. But
the reason we asked you to join us today is just to say thank you. You guys have been with us from the beginning, and throughout this whole crazy run, we could not have done it without you. And we just wanted to bring you on one last time to say thanks for all of the great book recommendations. Thanks for all of the time you spent, and just thanks for being friends.
Aww. Thanks, guys.
That's super awesome. We absolutely were so grateful for the time that you gave us and the laughs and the books and the pandemic. It was all just incredible.
Well, I mean, Steve did leave and then pandemic happened, so...
The timing is suspicious.
I never left you guys. This is weird. I feel like this is some kind of alternate reality. What are you talking about?
Yeah, he's right there.
Maybe the Steve was the friends we made along the way.
Oh.
I think that's the moral of this very special last episode of Writer Types.
I was hoping you were going to turn out to be a ghost.
That's been your wish since we met.
Well, so, okay, Dan and Kate, how has your time been? How have you, let's do a little exit interview. How would you rate your time on Writer Types?
God. Well, I mean, I'd give it a 9. It would be a 10 if we could have gotten the time zone thing figured out between Minnesota and California, like earlier on.
Well, it's okay. So over your time reviewing books for us, is there anyone, a specific author, a specific book that you found during doing the job that you think you maybe wouldn't have found otherwise?
I actually have a notebook that I keep all of my reviews in. I put all my notes. So I could actually like go back and like, oh yeah, I read that and I read that. And I found two authors that I don't know that I would have necessarily picked up on without having the opportunity to do the book reviews. One is Lola on Fire by Rio Ewers. Yeah, Rio Ewers.
That's how I've been pronouncing it.
I wouldn't have found him or the book without the podcast. And I really, really enjoyed the book. I mean, it was something that I had never read before. Totally new to me author. So that was great. And the other one was Mia Manansala, was an author that I kind of like had an awareness of, but I think having the opportunity to do the book review was a good opportunity to like force me to read her book, Arsenic and Adobo. And I really enjoyed that one as well.
Dan, how about you?
Jar of Hearts, Jennifer Hillier. That was one of the times when I put on my big boy reviewer pants and messaged an acquaintance, more of a stranger than an acquaintance, and said, hey, could I have a copy of your book for Writer Types? And not only did I find a new favorite author, but Hillier just became such a cool person to know and a great friend. And then we got to meet in real life at various conventions and everything.
My memory's being jogged here. Is Jar of Hearts the book that you threw in the freezer?
It sure is. Yeah, this book freaked me out so bad that, like Joey from Friends, I threw it in the freezer.
Well, I'm glad that we could bring these authors into your lives.
Yes.
And that you could bring those books into the lives of our listeners.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Super great.
Yes, that's right. Because people have been listening to you this whole time. I don't know if you know that.
What about you guys? What books did you discover?
That's a fair question. And it's so hard to try to narrow that down, because I think especially in the last probably 2 years, because when we started, it was just pulling from our friends, right? It was people that we'd know, people that we'd met. Hey, do you want to do us a favor and come be on the show? And then once we got on the radar of publicists and stuff, I keep getting sent, you know, way too many books that I could never have the time to read. But I've just been really happy that I've gotten a chance to get exposed to a lot of different authors. You know, like you say, Kay, I mean, I think that the amount of cozies that have been sent our way and that we didn't turn our noses up at them. It's like you say, it's not really my thing, but I've been exposed to a lot of really great authors with some really fun books in that whole genre that I was not really that well versed in. And then getting a chance to talk to a lot of authors, you know, I think of someone, an author like Robin Geigel, whose debut novel By Way of Sorrow is probably something that could have easily just been marginalized and said, oh, put this on the LGBT shelf. And you wouldn't find it if you were just looking for a mystery.
Sure.
So that's been one of my favorite things about the show, is being able to take a book like that and, you know, show it to a wider audience and say, hey, this, if you like mysteries, if you like thrillers, you're going to like this stuff. You're going to like Dharma Keller's, you know, Jinx Ballou series. You're going to dig it. They don't have to be shelved in a certain section. You know, I think that's a fun byproduct of doing the show.
When I was thinking back about my time on Writer Types and a lot of the books and authors and cool people and events and awesome experiences that I was exposed to, I connect it really strongly with discovering and falling in love with the writing of Blake Crouch. Like that, I think, yeah. Blake Crouch is the author for me that during that stretch, Dark Matter and Recursion in particular, and then getting to interview Blake, I think we were at BoucherCon, right, Eric? Is that when we did that? Yeah. My favorite memory about that is he was really cool and open, and it was a great conversation. But two, we were so paranoid that we weren't going to record it that I'm pretty sure we had four recording devices going, like both of our phones on memo, and then like a laptop with a podcast, and then like my iPad, just to make sure that we were going to actually record it.
From interviewing perspective, who was like the big like whale that you got that you were like super excited that you couldn't believe you got the opportunity to interview?
The big get.
Yeah. Who was your big get?
You know, we had a few, definitely. I think when in one weekend we talked to Lee Childs, Ian Rankin, and Lawrence Block, I think that was like all in one afternoon. Mm-hmm. That's when I was like, oh, this is going well. This is pretty cool.
We're doing okay.
I think too, on the flip side of that, like one of the things that I remember when we were initially coming up with the concept for the podcast, when Eric and I were, I think we were at a cafe outside a bookstore in like Orange County. And one of the things we talked about was like supporting lesser known authors, supporting our friends who are published authors, supporting authors that we just love who don't maybe get enough support. And I'm pretty proud of our ability on this show to also support that level of authors, mid-list, people you might not have heard of, indie published. I think we did a really good job of balancing some of the major names and some of the major publishing houses with indie publishers, and talking about short fiction and talking about the entire ecosystem that crime fiction and mystery fiction has to offer. And I think it's a feather in all of our caps that we were able to support those people in that way as well.
Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
That's the more water lifts all boats.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, all right, Dan and Kate, let's not drag this out. It's not a goodbye. It's just a so long. And we can continue these talks. And I, for one, am telling you, don't stop telling me about books. If you got something that you really love, let me know about it.
We'll do. Yeah.
And we'll make sure and share your email addresses very publicly so people can also ask you for recommendations there.
That's a good idea. Awesome. And thanks, Steve.
And because we're polite Minnesotans, we'll answer them all.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan and Kate, it's been an incredible pleasure. This has been always one of the highlights of doing an episode, is when I know I get to talk to you guys. And I value our friendship, and I feel like it's only grown deeper through doing the show. And that's one thing I really appreciate. And I really look forward to talking with you soon, which we will do whether we broadcast it to people or not.
Love you guys.
Thank you so much for the invite to be part of this.
Bye-bye.
We can't leave without thanking all of the authors who took the time to talk to us, especially in the early days when we were nobodies and we had some really, really big names that agreed to be on the show, which was really helped put us on the map. So we're incredibly grateful to every author who spoke to us over the years.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, all the publishers, the publicists, the indie authors and stuff, people who sent books. I mean, look, it has to be said, the biggest perk of doing the show is I've gotten 4 years of getting free books just sent to me. That's been pretty amazing.
Yeah. I do know you love books, and I know that's a huge perk, but I mean, and to the fans too, right? Like the people who got into this show early and vocally supported it, and as silly as it sounds, retweeting or saying nice things about us or leaving reviews, every one of those things gave us a little extra energy to keep pushing forward, especially when we were creating this thing. And your support and the nice notes we got and the emails and the comments we heard in person at VoucherCon, I mean, it was really touching, and it always really meant a lot to me and you. And I just think it needs to be acknowledged, because really, without listeners, what's a podcast?
Exactly. All right, Steve. Well, it's been a great run. It's sad to see it go, but like I say, I think we both leave with no regrets. We're proud of what we've accomplished. And so one last time for everyone, thanks for listening.